Hello, homies. Today's episode involves the discussion of multiple child murders, as well as some very gruesome crime scene details. If you're not okay listening to that, I highly recommend skipping this episode, and we will see you after our break in January. Thank you so much for listening, and on to the episode.
All right. The Honorable Skin Dog is here to pass down sentencing. And all right, you know, I've heard your testimony here, Miss B, and I gotta say, I'm quite disappointed with what I've seen. Not only have you spit in the face of the law, but these parking tickets will not go, remitted. So you will have to pay the full fine, as is the letter of the law here. But also, I just straight up don't like you.
What?
Yeah, that's right. I don't like you. You know what? Fuck you. This is a live taping. I don't give a shit. Fuck you. I'm flipping you two birds here right now. You're rude and combative and assertive. I don't like that. You're going to get paddled. And I'm going to give you a wedgie. And I'm going to hang you up on the flagpole. Because I don't like you. And you have a stupid name.
I'm pretty sure I can file a suit for that.
Yeah, appeal this, bitch. Hello!
Hello!
And welcome to
Homegrown Horror.
Our final episode of this calendar year.
Season
Mainline.
Season 2 coming to an end.
Oh boy, and we've got a fun one planned.
No.
A 10 out of 10
There's
bad
time.
There's
a fucking asterisk there with fun. I'm Bea, co-host.
I'm Jackson, a co-host.
And we like to talk about main spooky things. True crime, cryptids, hauntings, aliens, anything you can think of. We've got it.
We got it.
And today I am delivering on the worst type of goods. How are you doing? Before that, temperature check. What's up?
Ah, fine. Work is very, 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 very busy right now, but that's okay. All bad things and good things come to an end. All things end. So we'll get over it. But
fair.
Something I'm excited about is planning D&D with you and quite a few other people.
Yes. And you're going to DM this time.
I'm DMing. From the twisted mind of Jackson comes our next D&D campaign.
If you've listened to any of the skits, which mostly come from Jackson's twisted mind, with a little bit of me thrown in there.
Some goofiness. We love goofums.
We love goofums. And I've decided I'm going to be the most goofums of them all.
Yes.
I'm going to be a bard.
You're going to be a bard. It's just goofums from here on
Only
out.
Only goofums from here on out.
I love that, though. We haven't really had any bard characters in previous games we've played. So it'll be good. I think it's going to be a pretty wacky group
I'm
overall.
Very excited to improv some poems and songs.
You're going to do some poems and songs?
Well, fuck yeah. That's
Hell
the
yeah.
whole bard part.
Hell yeah, dude. I love it.
Yeah, one time Allegra was a bard, and I think it just got lost.
Yeah, it's hard.
Yeah, it was the very first time we played. I'm thrilled.
Probably like not the best for a new player, unless you really, really, really want to do that specific thing.
Right. I think I really, really want to do that specific thing.
Perfect. Great. We love it. Oh, how about you? How are you? Good?
I'm doing good. This week has just kind of been, you know, rolling along. We have mostly finalized our plan for Halloween. We are going down to, or going up, to trick-or-treat with our niece, Pauline.
Aww.
And it is going to be so much fun.
She's
going to be a black, I think I mentioned this to you, I don't know if I mentioned it on the pod. She's going to be a black cat, so we are going to dress as witches.
Wonderful.
I'm so excited.
That'd be very cute, yeah.
Yeah, because unfortunately where we live, our neighborhood gets no trick-or-treaters. The first Allegra cried that we had like one little baby ladybug come up. We've left treats out the last couple years only to have nobody.
It's you're kind of on a slightly busy main street.
Yes.
So I guess that's why you don't have too many people coming down.
And also like most of the city town, whatever, not what the fuck you'd call it, where I live, is just, like, it's the type of place where there's, like, one sidewalk on one side of the road.
Yeah, yeah, so it's not...
It's walkable.
I'd say you're more walkable than some other areas, it's not really, like, fun walking.
No, it's not.
You're going to, like, the stores.
I also think a lot of people these days... Allegra and I were sort of talking about the fact that Halloween was felt a lot more fun when we were kids.
Yeah.
And that's also not just the fact that most parents opt to, like, trunk or treat, mm-hmm. or some neighborhoods are like, oh, we're, you know, if Halloween's during the week, we'll move it to the weekend. It's also, like, when we go to the store, like, Target is mostly picked over in terms of Halloween stuff.
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
And, like, the costumes are just, a lot of the costumes are just, like, trademark stuff now.
You don't want to go as Bumblebee from Transformers?
No. Like, I was, okay, so, like, I had a mix of them.
Yeah.
Like, there was one Halloween where I was a sky dancer, but I've been a pumpkin, I've been a witch, I've been a vampire. I was Gothica, not the Halle Berry Gothica. It was, like,
the Pokemon?
Goth princess. Oh, Goth. That's Gotharita.
Oh, okay.
I have been zombie, like, I've done just about, I was a zombie nurse, actually. I've been a spider. I've been, like, anything you can think of. And I've handmade a lot of my costumes as I got older, but, like, a lot of the costumes I had as a kid were still so fucking cool.
Yeah.
And it's just, like, it doesn't feel
I don't even remember half the costumes that I wore when I was a kid. Like, honestly.
Oh, I remember all of them. Halloween has always been, like, the bee's knees for me.
I was a dinosaur 1 year. Oh, I remember I went trick-or-treating at a point where I was probably too old to be trick-or-treating. Yeah. I don't know. I was like 14 or something.
I had younger sisters, so yeah. I was like, my mom would drive us around and Allegra and I would get out and like take them up to the houses.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So we got to continue doing that as we got older, which was stellar. But
I remember my last costume was Hunter S. Thompson, which was a strange choice for a 14-year-old. But I was a strange kid.
All right. Fucking weirdo. But that's one thing, like, it feels like we've started, like, we also have been watching, like, we watched Rugrats and Hey Arnold's Halloween specials.
Yeah, yeah.
Halloween specials are not the same.
No, not the same at all.
It does seem like Nickelodeon specifically does have that sort of Spookoween sort of thing going still. And we also watched Halloween Town, but it's like the old Nickelodeon specials and like the old DCOMs, which are Disney Channel original movies, for those of you who don't know, like they hit something. And it's not just nostalgia talking. Like it doesn't feel like people embrace Halloween the way that they used to.
Probably not. But I also, yeah, like, I don't know. I've never really been from a family that cared that much about Halloween.
Halloween,
it's like we would put out some candy for people. I'd go trick-or-treating. But yeah, I didn't have as much thrill of it. One time during college, I think the most I celebrated Halloween was freshman year, where we decided to watch a scary movie every single night of the month.
I always want to do that, but then things get in the way.
Great way to bring girls into the dorm.
I bet.
Yeah.
Hey, baby.
Hey, baby. Want to watch a scary movie?
Yeah. It's not like I had parents that were like, oh, we're going to like decorate the house and blah, blah, blah. But like, I loved Halloween. Like Allegra and I, all through high school, we threw huge Halloween parties.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it also helps that we were goth from like sixth grade onward. Yeah, so yeah. Like, for me, it was like, but it just felt like overall, like every neighborhood we went to, there were tons of kids, and like it doesn't feel that way anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with
and
you.
And it makes me sad. Yeah. Also, now that like Halloween is an actual holiday for us, like it's Samhain, so I miss that sort of energy.
Yeah, yeah.
It makes me very sad, and I don't know, man. It's not the same. It's not the same.
It's not the same.
No. Okay, enough of that. So
let's talk about our bad stuff.
Yeah. So I have the pleasure of starting season 2 with a multi-state murder case.
Ending season two?
Nope, I started one. Oh, you started one. Yeah, because okay. We started with Israel Keyes, and so I am going to be bookending that and ending season two with a multi-state murder case.
Woo!
Which is also just as rough as Israel Keyes. So, back, buckle up. Grab your stuffies. And, here we are. So we're going to begin in the most unlikely of places. Nebraska, September 1983.
That's not Maine.
Well, we'll get there. Don't worry, we'll get there. It was early morning of the 18th when 13-year-old Jenny Jo Eberle, who had been delivering newspapers, disappeared on his route in Bellevue. He had delivered to only 3 houses. He was supposed to hit 70. He only got 3. And this prompted residents to complain that they had not received their issues of the Sunday Omaha World Herald. They're going to learn that this is the least of their problems. Just
the smallest.
This is small potatoes compared to what happens next. So this leads to a search for Danny, and his father found his bicycle abandoned on the side of the road near the next house that was on his paper route.
Oh no.
So the search intensifies. The local police call FBI to assist with finding the young boy. And in the wee hours of the morning of September 21st, Danny's remains are found in a very bad way. His hands and feet had been bound, his mouth was covered with surgical tape, and he was wearing nothing but his undershorts. His body was covered in stab wounds. One reportedly was 11 inches wide and was down to the bone.
That seems more than a stab wound. It's a big old slice. That's, oh, fuck.
So as the community begins to grieve, the investigators start in on trying to find clues and leads. They have one, which comes from the medical examiner, reports that he found a pebble in Danny's mouth, which was under the tape. So police start scouring, trying to be like, okay, we need to find like a match for the pebble. Like, where is this sort of terrain in town? That turns out to be an error, and the medical examiner's like, oh, sorry, I mixed up Danny's case with another dead boy. I'm so sorry.
Oh, no, he didn't have the pebble in his mouth. Okay. There's also two dead boys.
So the police is like, excuse me?
Excuse me. Why'd you fuck this up?
So throw that out the window.
Yeah.
Now they have...
zero. Nothing.
Yep. Like, the only thing that they have is they do have a rope. The rope that he was bound with, which the crime lab analyzes it, and they find that there is a hair/fiber that did not match Danny.
Okay.
So this is really the only physical evidence that they have.
So it was a hair, just a follicle of hair.
Yeah, and also this is in the 80s, so it's not like this is...
it's not super accurate forensics right now.
Yeah, I don't know about this time if they have like DNA, but... because I know I've heard, like, you know, you hear, like, oh, well, it's a visual match, which...
what does that mean? It's like I put it under a microscope and...
they're both
like
blonde.
Other person. Yeah, exactly that.
You know, Danny's hair is one color and this is another. I think that's pretty much what we
so
have.
So you're telling me that we're on the look for a blonde person.
Kind of.
That narrows it down quite a bit here in Nebraska.
Yeah, so... the FBI brings in Special Agent Robert Ressler, who profiled their killer. Thought, have you ever read, like, an FBI profile?
Robert Ressler, that's his name?
R-E-S-S-L-E-R, Ressler.
Okay, fine,
not
fine.
Ressler.
Yeah, no, I wanted Ressler.
I'm sorry. Have you ever...
I got very excited. I imagined this investigator with, like, a luchador mask.
Oh, no. I mean, have you ever read an FBI profile?
Yeah, no short kings allowed. Looking for a good time, not a long time.
That's
nothing committed.
I'm pretty sure that's your Grindr profile.
Oh, my Grindr profile.
Yeah, yours.
Oh, damn it.
So
I wasn't aware.
I pulled this from a write-up from Catherine Ramsland on crimelibrary.org. So here is some of the findings of Special Agent Robert Ressler. Quote, there were a number of signals that the killer was not overly concerned with concealment, which indicated compulsive behavior, something that he could not easily control.
He rolled a one on sneak.
Yes. Ressler thought it was significant that the perpetrator had left Danny Joe's body in a place where he might have been seen. It was a dead-end road, but not far from an area where people would have been driving. In addition, the offender had picked Danny Joe up during the early daylight hours, and he hadn't bothered to take his prey further down the road to dump him in the river. To the offender, the body could be found fairly quickly, and his behavior indicated that he did not care. Even if it had still been dark when he left the body there, someone passing by could have easily spotted him or his vehicle in that spot. It was high-risk behavior. Other boys, including Danny Joe's brother, reported a man in a tan car that had followed them in the days before the abduction. He'd never approached them, but in light of these circumstances, it now appeared to be suspicious. He might have been scoping out the area and making his selection. Given the witness reports from the boys, Ressler knew that he ought to be on the lookout for a white man in a tan car. He added, based on his knowledge of sexual predators, that the man was probably young, in his late teens to early 20s. Danny Joe had been abducted from a white neighborhood, and no one had reported a suspicious stranger, which seemed unlikely if a black, Asian, or Hispanic male had been hanging around. I just want to pause.
They just said the quiet part out loud there.
Please digest that.
He looked like the other white people, so he wasn't suspicious.
Alrighty. Ressler believed that the lack of a report confirmed his instincts that this had been a white man. It seemed possible, since there was no sign of resistance or a struggle, that the man was either friendly or non-threatening, and that Danny Joe had known him and felt safe. There was also reason to believe that the perpetrator was not experienced with killing. In fact, Ressler ventured to say that it was his first time. Quote, I thought it had to be his first murder, unquote. It might also be the case that there had been more than one male operating together, one to lure the boy and one to hold him down during an assault. The method of dumping suggested panic rather than experience, but the perpetrator was more than likely familiar with the area because he knew about the dead-end road.
Mm-hmm.
Ressler did not believe that Danny Joe had been bound while held captive. Besides being local, the perpetrator was thought to be in possession of no more than a high school education. He was likely employed in a job that required few skills. While the crime had likely been pre-planned, it seemed to lack follow-through, as if only one part of the fantasy had been worked out, which seemed to show lack of intelligence as experience. Because it seemed to have been a sexual crime without penetration, it seemed likely that the perpetrator was driven by fantasies, but not by experience, except for some forced molestation of young children when he was a child. He was probably single and likely had a mental imbalance or emotional problem that had long been part of his life. He was a deviant, to be sure, but it was not altogether clear in what manner. In terms of what to look for, Ressler thought that, given the possibility that Danny Joe was held captive somewhere for a couple of days, the perpetrator might have missed some time at his job, if he was employed. The fact that he had been out early in the morning suggested that he might have been up all night drinking, and that he had no one to report to. Substance abuse might have empowered him to actually commit the crime. Ressler thought that he'd considered dismembering the body, but had decided instead to dump it. His killing seemed tentative and spontaneous rather than clearly planned. The killer had also made some unusual wounds on Danny Joe's leg and shoulder. That's the 11-inch mark. And then the back of his neck was also slashed as well, possibly to conceal a bite mark. He indicated that the perp was probably a loner with latent homosexual tendencies who worked in some capacity that brought him close to children, such as a coach or Boy Scout leader. He did not believe the man was a serial killer, unquote. All right. Thoughts?
A lot of assumptions for very little on the scene. So
yes.
But
that is what FBI profilers do.
They just like throw everything at the wall. Mm-hmm. Just a whole lot of assumptions. Big old assumption pile here. Now, I wouldn't say that all of them are uninformed, but like... Mm-hmm. I think the level of detail is very interesting to go to. Like,
he's a single white male.
We're going with unemployment and... Yep,
unemployed or... Unemployed. We're one that doesn't have skill.
We're claiming like, inexperience. Yeah, claiming there's no skill, low intelligence. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, maybe I guess because they didn't really do a whole lot to conceal the dumping. Inverse of that, they could just be arrogant. That doesn't indicate that they would be technically low intelligence, but maybe mm-hmm. they are narcissistic and arrogant to assume they won't get caught because what was all that was left on the body? A hair follicle. And yeah. we don't have enough to pin that on. Other than that, it doesn't seem like we have much to go on here to actually find out who this person is. But yeah, I mean, inexperienced? Yeah, maybe. If it's sort of like, this doesn't really make sense as to the randomness of this encounter, claiming race, I mean, I guess, but that's really
the way
they said it was really fucking weird.
The reasoning is very 1980s.
Yeah, 100%. It's like, it had to have been white. We didn't get any calls of any suspicious colored people over there.
Like, whoa, that's holy fucking shit.
It's like, you all are weird.
mm-hmm.
Oh, 1980s FBI.
So that's what we've got.
At least they're better than 1980s CIA.
I'm just going to breeze right over that. So they have the one piece of physical evidence, which is the rope. And they are puzzling over this one piece of evidence. And about a week after the murder, a young man was arrested for molesting two boys. So law enforcement is like, that's our guy.
They're rubbing their little fly hands together.
So they bring him in for questioning. And they search his home, and he's got some sketchy stuff, like some rope, some tape, knives, and they're like, that's him!
That's a trifecta of suspicious material.
But Wrestler watches the police interrogate him, and he's like,
not the guy.
It's not him.
He's just a freak.
It's not him.
Just a freak with an assortment of sketchy objects.
They're also like, but his hair is a visual match to the one that's found on the rope.
Look at him! He's a blonde! Open and shut, Kate, boys.
I don't really know what...
No other blondes own rope, duct tape,
we don't even know if it's blonde. So, like, I don't really know what led Wrestler to believe this, but I don't know if he's just sort of like, nah, this guy didn't kill anybody. Like, I don't know.
I got him with my suplex of truth, and he didn't confess to anything.
Okay, All Might. So they are like,
hey. United States of Interrogation.
They're like, okay, so they let him go. Or I don't know if they let him go or if they probably booked him on the other charge of molesting two boys. They start questioning other known pedophiles in the area, and a local bank also offers a $40,000 reward for information leading to the killer. And nothing leads to a solid case. So they kind of are like, let's hope this is a one-off and just... They didn't close the case, but it sort of fell to the bottom of their priority list.
Yeah.
But then, on December 2nd of the same year, 12-year-old Christopher Walden, who is the son of a military officer, disappeared in Papillon. I don't know if you'd say it like Papillon.
Papillon!
Papillion is probably how they say it in Nebraska. Papillon. He's walking to school, and he disappears.
Uh-oh.
His remains were found 3 days later by hunters in a small wooded area. And I'm going to put a trigger warning probably at the very beginning of this episode. So
I got to say, hunters end up finding a lot of bodies.
Fuck. Christopher is found in only his undershorts, and he also had been mutilated in addition to multiple stab wounds. His throat had been slashed so violently that he was almost decapitated.
Oh, fuck!
And there was a carving of what appeared to be a plant found across his chest and abdomen. Like, this is a...
Carving of a plant?
Yep. So they're like, this looks like leaves and these look like roots. Yeah, that's what we got. And they determined that he had bled to death.
Oh my gosh.
Law enforcement believed almost immediately that the killer was the same one that had taken Danny's life and began immediately looking for any more clues that they could find.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which is, because it's interesting, because Catherine Ramsland, she had noted the fact that there had been another disappearance of a newspaper boy that was a little bit further away in a more major city, and police were like, no, those aren't related. But they were very quickly like, Christopher and Danny's murders are absolutely related.
Okay, interesting.
It's probably the way the bodies were found.
Yeah, yeah, they're so similar.
Yeah, there's some differences, but I think just, I don't know how they determine that sort of thing, but right, they are right. I'm just going to put it out there. They're correct. So it's not until January 11th in 1984, so less than a month later, that police received a call from Barbara Weaver, who is a teacher at Aldersgate Preschool. She had been keeping
Aldersgate?
Mm-hmm. Oh. Not Baldersgate. Aldersgate. She had been keeping an eye on a suspicious vehicle that had been slowly driving by the school. The driver was a young man, and he had looped by twice and was, like, keeping an eye on her, which sketched her out. So he returns a third time. He exits the car and he approaches her and he asks her for directions, which she said, I gave him directions. So per the court documents, quote.
Have you ever given someone directions? Sorry to no. pause here. I've lived in a couple cities and for some reason I have the talk to me face of like people coming up to me and always asking me for directions.
Unfortunately, so do I, because yeah. I accidentally make eye contact with people when we're in New York.
And oh, I'm yeah, like, yeah, yeah. Fuck! Yeah, you know, yeah, you're too approachable. Yeah, you can't be looking at people in New York. No. Hi! Can't be doing that shit.
I don't say hi!
It's like, oh, now another, another person from the Midwest.
No, I just stare straight ahead.
Yeah, that's what, yeah, that's the social norm. But when I lived in D.C., I would do my thing. I wouldn't look at anybody. I would, like, keep to myself. And people were asking me for directions, like, pretty consistently when I lived there. And it was funny because I was like, I didn't live there that long. I'm pretty confident I gave one person, like, wrong directions. Absolutely. You know what's really funny, though? It's like, people ask me for directions, and I do the same almost passive-aggressive thing every time when I don't know what the fuck they're talking about. Because they'll ask me, like, hey, where's this specific hotel? And I'm like, I don't know. It's like, do you know the street it's on? No. And I'm like, why would I know which hotel this is? So this is what I'll do. I take my phone out, and I Google it. And I was like, Google says that it's over there. Have a nice day. Okay. One time I did that, though. I misread the streets. And I was like, oh, it's over there. Like, go 6 blocks.
Well, they didn't pass by you, so I think you're fine.
Yeah, it was fine.
Well, let's just say this guy was not actually fucking looking for directions. So per court documents, quote, he claiming he could not understand her directions, he asked to use the phone. She said there was no phone inside the school. At that time, he pushed her back inside the room and said to her, get back in there or I'll kill you.
Whoa!
The teacher pushed
Jobert. He's a little suspicious.
Yeah. The teacher pushed Jobert out of her way and ran by him down the street to a nearby home where she called the police. She gave police the license plate number of the car she had seen and also indicated the person in the car looked like the composite sketch of the suspected killer of both of the young boys.
I'm fucking sorry they had a composite sketch.
They did. That had appeared for approximately a month in the local newspaper.
What the fuck? So they made a composite sketch with, like, no actual visual information about him, just based on their FBI profile?
I realized that I also skipped a part where, so after Christopher was murdered, they had two witnesses, and they hypnotized them.
What?
I forgot I edited that part out, because there was just, like, a lot of, like, clunky details, but yes.
They hypnotized the witnesses to give them information?
Yes, they did.
That I don't think that's how that should work. Yeah. Like, oh, you don't remember anything? We're hypnotized. We saw something. Can you tell us? Actually, JK, let's get this hypnotist in here. He'll fucking bring the information out of you.
I don't know.
Do you want me to get Wonder Woman's lasso of truth out here? Maybe that'll pull the information out of you.
I think I think what the idea was, this is the 80s. I think the 80s idea was like, in order to get a more truthful witness testimony, you have to like take out all of, you know.
I went to the tarot reader the other day and they told me I'd meet someone tall, dark, and handsome. So I think that's who we should be looking for.
Exactly. So I don't think they ended up doing much with it because so there were two women. They both agreed it was a young, short, white man who one of them said was wearing a knit cap. The other one said, I don't remember a cap. And then one of them was able to give them the first seven digits of the license plate. But you need all the license plate numbers because there's a lot of fucking combinations in Nebraska.
Couldn't you? Oh, come on. How many could there
be? I don't know. They said it would take forever. So I don't know.
Bullshit! There's probably going to be like 100 license plates. It's like, okay, we got to fill in the combination of the last digit here.
So here's the thing. I will say, because they were like, we're looking for a tan vehicle. The vehicle was not tan, nor did the license plate match anyway. The woman's the hypnotized woman's testimony. So go figure. So they run the numbers for the plate that the teacher provided, and police pick up 21-year-old John Jobert on Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska.
Ooh.
So he's a recent Air Force recruit from Maine.
No skills.
You don't need skills in the Air Force, apparently.
Apparently.
So, white man, correct. I will say he did only have a high school education. He graduated from Cheverus.
Well, you said that with gritted teeth. You got something to share about? You got some opinions to share about Cheverus?
Cheverus was the
best school in the state?
No. So it is the all-boys school. It was an all-boys school.
It was an all-boys school.
Because Catherine McCauley was the all-girls Catholic school. Cheverus was the all-boys Catholic school.
Oh. And then, they get up to some goofums up in there.
Sometimes in the 2000s, Cheverus was like, how do we, destroy McCauley? We're going to be co-ed.
Oh. Was that their intention, to destroy McCauley? So they just put it all at Cheverus? Do they have the same working budget between the two schools or something?
They didn't. Because I think Cheverus wasn't... I don't know if Cheverus was just like, Catherine McCauley was, affiliated with the fucking nuns. Like, the nuns lived at the school.
Oh, and they just got rid of all the nuns? They're like, pack up, penguins, go find somewhere else to live.
That's actually kind of what happened.
All right.
Because McCauley had a very, very slow decline after that. So, my opinions aside, there are some things that I think, I think him saying, low-skill job, I don't know, when you enter the Air Force, maybe you're in the lower rung. But he definitely had somebody to fucking report to. I don't think you can just miss time in the armed forces.
I mean, there is, jokes about how dumb you have to be in certain, in some armed forces. But, I think in the Air Force, I mean, you have to, have some skills. I don't know what his intention was with being in the Air Force. There are so many... I think with the Air Force, there's actually a huge nuance of the various jobs you can be doing.
Yeah.
And it's, pilot or, technician or, specific, things here and there. I think there's a lot that goes into the Air Force specifically. Same with Navy. I was going to go to the Navy at some point.
Her dad was in the Navy.
Oh, cool.
And he was like, I was smart because his brothers were in the Army. And he's like, I didn't have to do shit.
No, that was kind of also my thought process with the Navy. I remember, I remember I was 19 and I was seriously considering going to go to the Navy. So I'm glad I didn't, though.
Yeah. It's interesting sort of comparing who we actually got to the, this FBI profile is so he is a single white man. He did say he was young. He's in his 20s.
Yeah.
He's 21, I think, when they pick him up.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes and no. He's also single. He's
ready to mingle.
He is an out homosexual, which we'll get to. So, it's some of the things tick the boxes. Other ones I'm like...
Well, I mean, you can't just throw out a bunch of fucking assumptions. I can say that, he could probably say maybe not as intelligent, I guess, but it's he could say inexperienced, I guess, that part, It's the race thing is really still bothering me.
It bothers me.
Well, I mean, but he's also probably not wrong just with the way people would react to a colored person in their neighborhood
in the 80s.
And the if it's a specific neighborhood that's like
so
affluent and racist.
Here's the thing where he's like, he's not very smart. So he does have an IQ of 123.
Oh, that's pretty high, I think.
That is pretty high, which is funny. It's 123. But yeah, so he's not
that's like
stupid.
That's above average for sure.
Mm-hmm. You know? I think I'm more with you in terms of like, I think he was a little
cocky. Have you ever done an IQ test?
No.
I don't think I have either. Like, I don't know. My favorite is like when I hear someone of like says, oh, I took an IQ test online. And I'm like, you did not take an mm-mm. IQ test. And now I know how smart you are.
So,
just from that telling me that.
Yeah. They arrest him. And he confesses.
Immediately?
Yeah.
Like, okay. No, I mean, he had to... Did he play coy at all at any point?
I don't know. Everyone's just sort of like, he confessed.
He confessed?
They also... So, according to Marco Magaritov...
Quote, he's the opposite of Shaggy. Yeah. It was me.
When the authorities searched his barracks, they found a hunting knife and the same rope that was used to bind Eberle.
Dude was straight up just in the barracks. Okay. Yeah.
Collected as evidence, the rope was determined by the FBI to have been made in South Korea for the U.S. military. Jobert was arrested and taken in for questioning, and he confessed to the murders of Eberle and Walden.
Wait. So the rope was specific to, like, a U.S. Yep. military? What the... Wait, no. Okay. Come on. So the FBI was investigating this.
Yep.
They created all these random assumptions. Yep. But they didn't do that deep of an analysis on the rope to be like, this is very specific to this specific rope.
Bingo.
Look, I get it. Like I'm not a rope guy either. I would consider myself a rope layman, mm-hmm. you know? So it's like, I can't tell the difference between rope, but I would kind of expect a little bit more mm-hmm. investigation into the rope. Like a special rope. It's like, if I could look at a fancy rope, I could probably say, this is a weird looking rope. Mm-hmm. And then say, we should probably look up what this rope is used for.
Correct. When asked if he would kill again, and this is about to answer your question, Jobert said quite plainly he was grateful to have been caught, as he undoubtedly would have. Quote, that is my big worry, said Jobert. It is scaring me quite a bit. Yes. Unquote. Despite multiple evaluations suggesting that Jobert was obsessive compulsive and suffered from a schizoid personality disorder, the law determined that he was in his right mind while committing his crimes. Unquote.
Okay, so he's saying, I'm not of the right mind, but everyone's was like, you knew what you're doing.
Yeah. So, like, I think that's why.
You did this on purpose. So he's kind of a little of a.
Gave in so easily, but
he talks all fancy, you know, he's like quite a bit, and you know, like that's very interesting of a response. I don't know, sounds like a sociopath.
And I think so, because I've got some more for you. We're not done.
Cool.
So subsequently he was charged with 2 counts of first degree murder, to which he pled guilty. Like, he entered a guilty plea. Like, he's not trying to hide this. In October of 1984, he was sentenced to death by electric chair on both counts. Now, Nebraska.
Electric chair by both counts. 2 electric chairs. So it's like they put him in once and then they're like, all right, let's go again.
It is so weird how this works to me. They're like, okay, you have two, you're being sentenced for both to electric chair. It's sort of like when they're like, you're sentenced to like 3 life sentences. And I'm like,
we're going to clone you. And we're going to electrocute the clone.
So I feel like it's just to sort of. I feel like in that instance, like, you know, you can only kill them once, but it's like, it's to convey the severity of what they've done.
I think instead of doing this kind of thing, we should just be like, you are sentenced to life in prison, or you are sentenced to electric chair, and also fuck you.
Yeah, that's your second sentence.
Like to say 2 counts electric chair is like, you're going to die, also fuck you.
Yeah, it's weird. So through a fortuitous twist of fate, the police were able to match Jobert's dental records to teeth marks found at another crime scene in Maine.
Why is he biting things?
In August of 1982.
Is Stetson a boot? I think Stetson is a boot.
All right. In August of 1982, 11-year-old Richard Stetson had been jogging along the Back Cove Trail when he disappeared. When he didn't return home by nightfall, his parents had called the police.
Just then? Okay.
The next day, Richard's remains were found off of 295, which is really interesting because Murderpedia was like, off of a rural highway.
No. there was a bunch of trees everywhere. Well, like how far into 295, I guess, is... Actually, I know where 295 ends. This isn't a rural highway.
No, it's not. He had been strangled and stabbed to death with bite marks present on his body. Okay. So remember how the police had said like some of the more egregious woundings?
It was like slashing, yeah.
One of the more egregious woundings on Danny and Christopher may have been to hide bite marks.
Gotcha. Okay, so then this goes against the profile of like this being his first time. This
guy's just
This guy's just a freak.
Yeah. Jackson.
Oh, sweet, tender summer child Jackson.
We're not done.
Okay, good.
So police apprehended a possible suspect at the time, but they released him after a year and a half in custody because his bite mark didn't match.
Wait, so they got a guy?
Mm-hmm.
Just picked a guy?
Yep.
He's blonde. Let's get him, boys.
So, and it wasn't until 1984 when Jobert was in custody in Nebraska that they were like, oh shit, that's Richard Stetson's murderer. So in 1990, he was convicted in Maine a life sentence.
Did they give that other dude any money?
I don't know.
I'm always shocked. Okay, have you ever like seen... I'm really sorry. I'm going all over the place today. But it's the last episode. Come on. I'm not going to be able to do this for a while. Yep. So for the year. I'll preface. For the year.
Yeah, then we'll be back.
We'll be back in Jan. But like... I'm always fascinated by people who are wrongly imprisoned and like...
Fuck yes!
I always follow up with like, how much money did they get? And it's like appalling to me sometimes like what people get. I remember there was a guy that lost 23 years of his life or something. And it was like, what did he get after that? Like $60,000. I'm like, what the fuck is wrong with you people?
It's insane. It is insane.
It's like, no, give this man $20 million... Let him go live on an island. He deserves
it. He fucking deserves it. So, like I said, before you had questions. Anyway, so, in 1990, which is after his two electric chair sentences, he is convicted in Maine for the crime and is sentenced with a life sentence.
No. Okay. All right. So, all right. Can you imagine the judge?
You have to sentence him, right?
That's scheduling the sentencing is like, okay, all right, I could see the only way we're going to make this work out is that, I'm moving my hands like Donald Trump right now, we're going to make you serve your life sentence in Maine, and then we think you're probably not going to make another year, we're going to clone you, we're going to electrocute you, then we're going to electrocute the clone, that's going to fulfill our quota here.
I think it's just the severity of the crime, I guess. So
fuck you, and also fuck you again.
I like to focus on victims, but also at the same time, these are not his only victims. So we're gonna dig into
what? No.
So Jobert's crimes, the ones that he was convicted for.
Get me off this ride.
Were the end result of years of violent escalation.
Oh.
So he was born in 1963 in Lawrence, Massachusetts, and later in life, he freely admitted that by age 6, due to his mother's controlling nature, he began to hate her, and he wasn't allowed to see his father, so he started fantasizing about murdering and eating his babysitter at age 6.
Okay. At age 6?
Yes.
That's crazy. That must have been a shitty mom. Honestly. Come on. That can't have been just done in the vacuum. You know?
Yeah. So by the time he turned 11, he moved to Portland with his mother and he came out as gay, which led him to being ostracized and bullied by his peers, which, holy shit, coming out in like, if he's 11,
early?
So in the 70s.
That's bad. Yeah.
At 11.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, this continued to fuel his violent behavior. And also, asterisk, he's not violent because he's gay. Do not make that conclusion, listeners. Nobody, that's not what I'm fucking saying.
Nobody listening to this thinks that.
I'm just saying, because people jump to all sorts of crazy things. So I'm just putting it up there. This is not because he's gay.
Like, I mean, if I'm sitting next to a gay person right now, and I mean, she goes off the rails sometimes.
Oh, boy. So, according to Murderpedia's timeline, between the ages of 13 and 16, he committed a string of offenses. Quote, he stabbed a 9-year-old girl, Sarah Canty, in the back with a pencil, which, taking out of the quote for a second, this is the first, when he talks about this, he's like, that's the first time I felt sexual gratification.
What the fuck? Oh, okay. So, no. How old? 11?
That's at 13.
At 13, okay.
So, back into the quote. This was the first of a few attacks. After that, he got away with that. He slashed another girl with a razor blade while riding by on his bicycle. A few years later, he attacked an 8-year-old boy, Chris Day, and nearly strangled him to death. After that, he began using a knife to slash or stab people, but never killed anyone, unquote. When he was 17, he also attacked 2 more people, a 27-year-old woman who was critically injured after he stabbed her in the stomach, and a 9-year-old boy who survived after Jobert slit his throat.
Holy shit!
So that's when he's 17.
Yeah.
And then 2 years later, when he's 19, he murders...
Oh my god.
Richard Stetson.
Yeah.
So... You saying it's not in a vacuum, I totally agree with you. There's a lot of mental health here. But also, wrestler, buddy.
Ooh!
When he's like, this is his first time. No.
No.
And it's crazy to me. He did all this and either he, like, I don't know. I cannot believe he was not caught because he was then allowed into the Air Force.
That is really interesting. So he has this full record and he's still like allowed in.
Yep. He said it. Murderpedia also had said once he.
Was there like different. This was all before he was 18.
Yeah.
So there was probably some sort of like stipulations with crimes as an adolescent and how that reflects on you later in life, right?
They didn't say anything about like him being caught or anything like that.
So strange.
So I don't know, like, my assumption is, like, he just... But here's the thing. Even if someone has, like, a juvenile rap sheet, you'd still want to fucking see that if they're joining the Air Force, right?
I don't... Well, I mean, I don't know what the procedure was in the 1980s, but
if he commits a crime at 17, he turns 18, joins the... Or he joined the Air Force at, like, 1920. But, like, that's not that far away from each other.
No, that's not far away from each other, but I also don't know how adolescent juvenile records were treated back in the 1980s.
That's fair.
Like, I would assume that today that would probably be treated a little bit more seriously. I feel like less is like, especially with the Air Force, I feel like less is, you know, looked at to take you out of the Air Force because I think they try to make sure they keep somewhat pretty competent individuals in there. Especially if they're like, you know, fighter pilots and all that, you know. So
Murderpedia also noted like he went through a depression right after joining the Air Force because he made a friend in the Air Force and I guess he passed away or mm-hmm. lost him somehow. Yeah. And it's a weird detail to me because I'm like, I don't feel bad for this man at all. I don't feel bad his parents got divorced. I don't fucking feel bad.
Yeah.
I fucking don't. So it's very odd to me, like, that's a detail that's like, he went through a depression because he left. Murderpedia.
Murderpedia.
I understand you're like, here's some context, but it comes off as weirdly sympathetic.
I like Murderpedia overall. I me think too. Their information's been
but
pretty solid.
But this particular
solid.
Timeline, that was weird to me.
Yeah.
Just the well, way I mean, it was written.
Well, I mean, they also, like, relay mostly different articles that have appeared yes. specific to cases. So is that just the article itself?
No, they someone actually did a full timeline.
Like oh, okay. It was something wrote it that, up yeah. within Murderpedia.
I had never seen it on there, but like it was like this full like timeline and then had like a bunch of like detail like put into a table.
Okay. I've seen that sometimes on Murderpedia.
So like, I assume they have places, yeah. somebody fill that out.
Well, I mean, it might just be like how Wikipedia is operated. Just kind of anybody.
Fair.
Yeah.
So Jobert attempted to appeal his sentence in Nebraska. The appeal documents state, quote, after pursuing direct and collateral relief in the state courts, he filed a petition for a writ of habeas corpus in federal district court. The district court found that Mr. Joubert's death sentences were based on an unconstitutionally vague statutory aggravating factor and granted the writ. So they grant his appeal. The state of Nebraska appealed that. Joubert cross appeals the district court's denial of other claims presented in his habeas petition, unquote. What does that mean? Everybody's appealing. They're appealing, and he's trying to go on a technicality of like, you did something that was unconstitutionally vague in your wording.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So in response, all in all, the conviction was upheld. And he was executed in 1996 at the age of 33.
And then they immediately resuscitated him and electrocuted him again.
Up until his death, he continued to express his fantasies of killing young boys. Murderpedia said that he would draw on tissue paper.
They gave him a pencil?
I fucking guess so. But he continued to claim that he was now, quote, in control of his thoughts, unquote.
Doesn't seem like you are, man.
So, there's a lot that I did not talk about. And so during Joubert's trial and in the appeal documents, more gruesome details came out about the murders, and they painted a very, very, very detailed picture of Danny and Christopher's last moments. I don't want to discuss that here because it feels, I don't want to revel in the torture that was inflicted upon these children.
Yeah.
If you want more information.
This is a family program.
It's more of a, again, like, there's not a whole
lot. I'm sorry, I'm throwing so much bullshit at you.
Yeah, I'm just like, bro. So the documents are out there. I pulled others, you know, details from these documents. So if you want to dig further into this case, you totally can. It's more just about, like, I already feel like I talked too much about this motherfucker. I don't feel comfortable being like, let's talk about these children's last moments in a horrific way. It's fucking terrible. So
we already described the bodies, which is honestly bad, more than we normally do in a lot of cases.
I think I really wasn't sure how much I wanted to include, because like, I know with Sarah Cherry, I like was very careful about what I included.
When it comes to like children's death, we've omitted a lot of stuff.
But this one, it's like, just sort of like,
there. Yeah.
I felt like it was important to be like, this is how they linked it to him, and like,
yeah, I hear you.
Because I don't take joy in that, like, presenting this information. I hate it. So if there's
interesting
also,
podcast we've started then.
I know. So if you want further reading, the court case documents and the writings that were sort of written up from the FBI case are in the show notes, and
which is just in our episode descriptions.
Yeah. So the other thing is, for some reason, so there is like, he's been called the Nebraska Boy Killer and also the Woodford Strangler. Fuck this guy.
And fuck you again.
Fuck him three times, I guess. Because he convicted of three. Like, it's just so crazy to me that I'm just like, how do you just?
It's, it is kind of curious. So obviously a lot of like undiagnosed mental health issues at play here.
It's also the 80s.
So no one's like,
he has a very,
it's not really like,
tense relationship with his mother.
Apparently. Now that's the thing that I'm most curious about, was how bad his relationship was with his mother. If he's already fantasizing like killing the babysitter and shit, like, yeah, how bad is this mother? How bad? Mother of the year, obviously, you know, number one mom. That's the t-shirt she's got in the closet. So yeah. Pretty rough stuff.
Like, it seems like he was just upset that he wasn't allowed to see his dad.
Yeah.
That's the reason he gave.
Yeah.
So, but the thing is, like,
that's also, why does that lead you to kill a bunch of people anyway?
Exactly. But that's the thing is, like, I think that there's just undiagnosed mental stuff, because yeah, the fact that he was imagining killing and eating his babysitter at age 6 and started hating his mother at age 6.
But also,
something's going on.
Is that just him saying bullshit?
That's
also
fair.
You know?
That's fair.
Because it's like, I don't know. I've never
But, like, he started committing
I don't talk to many kids, but I've never met a six-year-old that, like, has seemed to be that violent.
I mean, you see it in some serial killer cases where, like, a lot of them will start mutilating animals at a young age. He skipped that step entirely.
Yeah.
And went right to stabbing little girls with pencils. I mean, he did start at 13, so there is a gap of time. But, like, the other thing is, I also kind of want to know, like, is he just saying, like, I did this, I did this, I did this, I did this? Or do we have documentation of him doing it? And it just sort of, like, got expunged when he became 18.
Yeah.
Questions that I have that I don't know are answered. There, like, that article from... God damn it. This is the second time I forgot her fucking name. I'm good at this. I'm good at my job.
This isn't a job. We don't get paid for it.
Catherine Ramsland. Like, there's a lot more. I was just really interested in, like, the FBI portion. She might later on in the article go on, and it was like a 22-page article.
Yeah.
She might later go on and describe that sort of thing. But, like, it's... I also don't want to spend a whole lot of time on him. Fuck this guy so hard. And I feel like... I feel so bad for the families in these instances because it's just like, holy shit. Like, all these kids were just doing, like, very normal things.
Yeah, yeah. Like,
I hate it.
Just out and about doing kid things, you know? You know? But, like, yeah, it's awful.
The other thing is, it's like, I would also like to point out, I'm pretty sure at the same Air Force base, when they were, like, questioning pedophiles, there was, like, an Army officer that was there that was, like, a known pedophile.
He was a known pedophile?
Yes. It's that whole, it's the misconception that, like, you're safe.
Yeah.
And, you know, the fact that even in, like, the FBI's, you know, in their profile, they're like, it's probably somebody who seems safe.
Yeah.
Like, who knows? He may have been, like, in his, like, Air Force attire, and he's like, hey, do you want to come, like, take a look at the base?
Wouldn't that be cool? Do you want to go look at a plane?
Yeah, I don't know. It's fucked up. I hate it. And that's how we're ending season two. So.
My goodness. Oh, God.
Fuck me.
Fuck you indeed, my friend. Well, that was not really fun. So we got to... Let's cheer things up here with our next mainism and last mainism of season two.
Hey, hey, it's a mainism.
B, when you got married, did you carry Leggy over the threshold? Did you do the threshold carrying at all?
We jumped over a cinnamon broomstick.
Of course you did, you freaks. I remember carrying Emily through the threshold because it was a little fun thing to do.
Yeah.
You know? Now, could you imagine doing that over 278 yards of an obstacle course?
I know what this is.
We're talking about the North American Wife Carrying Championship.
I know about this.
This has already happened this year. This is an early October event, so you've missed it. But this seems to be, comes from a Finnish tradition.
I also think this is really interesting because we both just had our anniversaries.
Yes. So I think we got to sign up for next year. I mean, it's a pretty
interesting
event.
You know
what?
We have a year. Let's train for it.
Let's train for
it. I've wanted to get buff so that way I can fight a bear in the woods. So you know what? I'll just change it to I want to get buff so I can carry my wife how many yards?
It's 278 yards all through right. An obstacle course. It includes a mud pit. Sand hills, you know, a lot of fun things, you know. So you got to be real technical with the way you carry your wife. But the winner will receive the wife's weight in beer and five times her weight in cash. So very interesting odds here. I think that's a pretty worthy, you know,
Allegra's gonna drink all that beer.
She's gonna drink all that beer. Is that PBR?
If we win, she'll split it with you.
Yeah, for sure. then yeah, we'll see. But yeah, I think doable, you know. But Easy. 278 yards, easy.
Easy, that's like squeezy.
Almost three football fields. No problem there.
Here's the thing. I'm pretty sure Allegra and I are like a similar weight, so it's basically like carrying myself.
It's $70 per couple. You're also, you know, this happens every year, early October in Newry, Maine. And again, this comes from
I think it'd be fun to just go watch,
too. It'd be fun to go see it, yeah. That'd be a fun time. So, hey, we'll see you there at the next wife-carrying championship, either as contenders or spectators. But seems like a fun time. Yeah. So, hopefully that cleansed the palate.
That's
here.
That's what I'm going to be doing for the next 2 months.
Just training.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Thank you all so much for coming along for season two of
Thank you.
Homegrown Horror.
Thank you for season two.
Yes. As we did last year, you will still get your November and December bonus episodes, and we'll see you again in January. In the meantime, you can always reach out to us at our Gmail, homegrownhorrorpod@gmail.com, or you can reach out to us on Instagram at homegrownhorrorpod. You can go down in Spotify, and there's a Q&A section. Sometimes I forget to put it. If it's not there, I'm sorry. Jackson always puts it on there, I think. So you can talk to us that way as well, or you can leave us some stars and a review on Apple Podcasts. But more than anything, just thank you so much for being here for 3 years, two seasons, and thank you.
That's really. All we can really say. Yeah. Thank you very much. Yeah. We it's a fun time, you know. This like is it's a labor of love.
Absolutely.
We take a lot of time out of our busy schedules to always make this happen. So thank you for your understanding as we kind of take a 2 months here to just kind of focus on family and be people for a little bit. But we hope you are out there. You celebrate the family with people you love. Peepees that you love. And yeah, thank you so much for joining us on this journey, you little freaks.
And we'll see you in January.
Bye.